Okay, thanks everyone for coming. To continue our journey through Jewish law. So those who are hopping on the train, it's a good place to hop on. You didn't miss anything. I mean, you missed something, but you can hop on now.
No, you're going to speak. I want to hear.
Okay, that's great. I want you to be here.
We did the other sessions that we had, you and I.
That was a good one.
And I've got the notes in here.
Parshas Ki Tzetzeh, I remember.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
it's worth it, you know?
I try. No, sure, mutual. So we talked about the Torah we give it at Sinai, the development of the oral law, the writing down of the oral law, because there was a concern that if it wasn't written down, then it would be forgotten. And then the universal acceptance of the Mishnah and the Talmud, and then the authorities that came afterwards. So last time we focused on the Rambam. The Rambam made a significant project to not only give the bottom line rulings based on the Talmud, of course, but also to organize it by topic. Meaning in the Talmud, there are different tractates. They're called, tractate Brachos, tractate Shabbos. So they deal in general with topics, but you can have a topic in Shabbos. You can have a topic about Muktzah, for example. A lot of it is, I just picked it off the shelf for the Talmud, but they're found in, Maseches Beitzah. Maseches Beitzah deals with Yom Tov. There's not necessarily like such an organized way to find things. So what the Rambam did is he took what he determined to be the final ruling and put them in a very organized format. Hilchos Shabbos, Hilchos Yom Tov, the Halachos of the Korbanos. And he didn't use the format of the Talmud itself, but he listed the bottom line rulings, what he determined were the bottom line rulings. And we discussed that, maybe some controversies about that. But now I want to look at basically one of the questions that comes out, in particular through the lens of a journey through Jewish law and the development of Jewish law, is the development of Ashkenazi and Sephardi traditions of determining Jewish law. Because Ashkenazi and Sephardi, within each one, it covers a pretty large range. Not all, there were even different customs within that. But the general division of Ashkenazi and Sephardi and why there are different customs or maybe even different rulings, how that developed. And that really develops in a more concrete way in the mid-1500s, where you really have a more defined practice, a more defined guidelines for Sephardim, and then some differences, at least the way it's a Shulchan Aruch, because the Sephardi is the main one, and then some differences for Ashkenazim.
So
So it would include
not Ashkenaz.
Right. So Sephardi does include like Sfarad from Spain, but also it includes the Middle East, Iraq, and even in the land of Israel was at least a certain point what would be considered a Sephardi community. And then Ashkenaz is really from north of that, from Western Europe to Eastern Europe. We'll see also how the two communities had interacted with each other, what influence they had on one another. So basically, from the time of the Talmud, so there became different efforts to codify law. You can learn the Talmud, but it's not always clear what the final ruling is, and people need to know what to do. So really, the first major effort and first major work to codify law, meaning just to not include the discussions of the Talmud, but to tell you what's the bottom line law, was the Rif. The Rif was in Spain, Rabbeinu Yitzhak Alfasi. Right, Rif is Rav Yitzhak Alfasi. So he was in the Spanish world and in the Sephardi world. And what he did is, show and tell, so you have some editions of the Gemara. The Gemara itself is a relatively small portion of what's published, but you have the Gemara, all the discussions. And then what the Rif did is basically he prints what the bottom line ruling is. So Shmuel says, Rav says, Abaye, Rava, Ishel Bei Shammai. So the Rif kept to the pagination of the Talmud. It kept to the format, meaning you are still basically working with the Talmud. If you wanted to look something up, so you still have to look it up within the orders of the Talmud, which the Rambam deviated from, and in some ways it makes it more organized, but it's also like, what are you doing? Now we have no way point of reference. Now we don't know where to look it up. So here would be just the bottom line ruling. So you have that, and then you see their commentaries around the riff. But that was the riff. Yitzhak Alfasi gave the bottom line rulings based on the Gemara. And then in the development of halakhas, we focused on the Rambam last time and what he did. But then around that time, so you have in Western Europe, the Chachmei Provence, the sages of Provence, of France, and also of Northern France. So that was Rashi, Shlomo ben Yitzchak, and that was his grandchildren, the Bali HaTosvot. So who are they? Why are they called Bali HaTosvot? So again, the show and tell. So Rashi is in most Masechtas, you have Rashi here. This is the Vilna pagination. It was later on, but you have a running commentary of Rashi, and then you have Tosvos. So Tosvos isn't really a person; it just means the additions. There were a couple of more stuff. So there are several Bali HaTosvos. Famous among them was Rabbeinu Tam, the Rashbam. They were in the family of Rashi, and they were in northern France. And Rashi has a running commentary on the Talmud. He also has a commentary on Tanakh, on Mishnayos. It's amazing what he did. It's amazing what all these people did. And he'll define certain words in the Talmud. He'll give context. And then the Bali HaTosvos were perhaps more focused directly on legal rulings and also analysis of the local place in the Talmud, the passage under discussion, and see if that has any contradictions or questions based on other places in the Talmud. So it's a little longer and more involved. So who were they? And we said that we'll learn where they lived, what they did, but also who were they? So Rashi lived in France, just around the time before the Crusades. The First Crusade was in 1096. He passed away in 1105. But that was the situation that they were dealing with at the time. He was a winemaker. I don't know if his Rashi Light was based on his recipe, but he was, in fact, a winemaker. And his grandson, Rabbeinu Tam, there were many other Bali HaTosvos, but to take one example, so Rabbeinu Tam, he really lived in the thick of the Crusades. He lived, Rabbeinu Tam, he lived 1100 to 1171. So this was right in the thick of the Crusades. And there's a story about, he had to, if you lived in France at the time of the Crusades, so, it wasn't exactly like you were sitting in your study free to learn and write in peace. So they certainly had to deal directly with the Crusades. And there is an account that during Shavuos of 1146, Crusaders entered the city when France where Rabbeinu Tam lived. They pillaged his home, took all of his possessions, desecrated a Torah scroll, and inflicted 5 knife wounds in his head. But miraculously, he survived, and a non-Jewish nobleman who had recognized him told the mob, go away, don't worry, he'll convert, he'll give in, just go away. So that he didn't end up obviously converting, but he was safe from that. But you see, he did have a close call, and it was probably, Baruch Hashem, he was able to survive, because he probably wrote a lot during the last 25 or so years of his life. But even after that, there were blood libels, a famous one in the 20th of Sivan in 1171, which was right at the end of Rabbeinu Tam's life, where they burnt the city's entire congregation, and Rabbeinu Tam decreed the day as a fast. So there are communities that still, but certainly who did, observe Chof Sivan, the 20th of Sivan, as a fast day. Which is also why the minhag is on Shabbos Mevarchim for Rosh Chodesh Sivan. There are different customs as far as saying Avah Rachamim, but generally we do say it, you'll say it during Sfira, but we say it on Shabbos Mevarchim of Sivan, because Avah Rachamim was composed during the times of the Crusades. Because that's, if you look at what it says, give, avenge the blood, and it's we do ask Hashem to avenge our enemies for what they did. And in general, in Sivan, there were massacres. And this period was, while it did produce tremendous contributions to the Torah world and to Torah study in general, it was a very hard period. And many of the kinos that we say in Tisha B'Av were written around this time. Even were written by Rashi in the times of the Bali HaTosfos. So this was the world that they were living in. But despite that, they were able to accomplish a tremendous amount. And they were very influential, at least in the Ashkenazi tradition of learning and of halachic development. And then you have, continuing on, just to note, this is basically what's called the period of the Rishonim, the early authorities. Obviously, they came after the Talmud, after the Gaonim, to the other Rishonim, and then you have the Achronim. Now, there was no real, start button for the period of the Rishonim, and stop button, and start button for the period of the Achronim, but roughly, the period of the Rishonim is from around the year 1000 to the mid-1500s, and then the Shulchan Aruch, we'll see exactly how that was developed. With the mid-1500s, kind of the divided line. And generally, those who came after the Shulchan Aruch are viewed as Achronim, and there's certain authority that the Rishonim have, but again, not really a clear cutoff point. But in the period of the Rishonim, so in among the other prominent Ashkenazi Rishonim, it was the Maharam Mirotenberg, the Maharam of Rotenberg. And he was we'll see more about the Rush, Rabbeinu Asher, who moves from the Sephardi, from the Ashkenazi, and then into the Sephardi world. So the Maharam Mirotenberg lived in Germany, 1215 to 1293, so a little bit after the times of the Bali HaTosfos. He was also dealing with a lot of difficulty. So he was handed over. There was a libel against him to the government, to the German government, and turns off to the Bayi, an apostate Jew. A lot of times the Jews at that time, probably due to persecution, but some did abandon Judaism, and they became a real source of pain and persecution to the Jewish people. They would then slander them.
Cornelius got his St. Louis because he drove all the Jews out of France.
Right, right. There were expulsions from the different areas.
And the Germans weren't much better at all, even then.
So apparently, it was an apostate Jew who handed him over to the Emperor Rudolf I, who then put the Maharam Mirotenberg in prison. But he was a very important person, so the people raised 30,000 marks to ransom him. That was what ransom was set at, and the people raised the money for him because he was the leader of the community. But he refused to be ransomed because the halacha is, the Mishnah in Gittin says, that you're not allowed to pay an exorbitant ransom to rescue a Jew. Why not? Why can't you pay an exorbitant ransom?
Next one will be even more.
Exactly. Then they'll know that, if we kidnap a Jew, they're going to stick up for each other. So now we can keep on doing it. So it's a difficult type. So up until a point, but if it...
Pidyon Shvuyim,
there's a very, very important mitzvah of ransom, but there is a limit. The Mishnah says that if it's an absorbent amount, so the Mishnah actually says there are two possibilities. Either it's because now they're going to be encouraged to kidnap more people, or it may deplete the funds of the community. But okay, if the community is willing to raise the money or has the means to do so, so then that may be allowed. But the concern is that if then they're gonna just raise the price because they know that they can get it. So even though yes, it's a very important mitzvah of pidyon shvuyim of redeeming captives. But then if it's going to result in getting more captives, then it can be a problem. It was a discussion. It's much too much to discuss now, but like with something like the Gilad Shalit, that's also a high ransom. Giving away 1,000 prisoners for, it was a question. It was not a simple thing. And that's the idea. Like, if, to put it in modern terms, that's the idea. You give 1,000 people away, yes, we value the life, but it's not so simple. But the Mari Mirutenberg refused to be ransomed, and he spent 7 years in prison, and he died in prison. He shows that the people who sometimes you think, oh, that's the luck, that's great, but when it comes to me, then I'll cheat a little bit. No, he did not allow himself to be ransomed. And then, even after he died, there was one philanthropist who paid an exorbitant sum to recover his body. And then he said he wanted to be buried next to him. But these were the conditions that the Jews lived in under during that time. So now you have one of the Mara Mirutenberg's primary students was Rabbeinu Asher ben Yechiel. Rabbeinu Asher ben Yechiel, known as the Rush, spelled like Rosh, people say the Rush, Reish Aleph Shin. So he did something similar to the Rif. Also found in the back of most Gemaras, is he also presented the bottom line ruling. But what he did, which was a little bit different, was he provides provides more of an analysis. I mean, the Rif would just copy and paste the practical portions, but the Rush, so he goes according to the order of the Gemara, but he gives more of an analysis. So it was a little bit expanded a little bit more on the concept that the Rif had innovated. So what was the story with the Rush? So he began in Germany. He was a student of the Mara Mirutenberg. But when he saw what happened to his teacher, and that in general the conditions weren't so good, so then he went to Spain. So he lived 1250 to 1327. And you see a little bit after that in Spain, it wasn't so good either. But that's why we went in circles in different places. Things weren't so good. Didn't stay for long in a lot of places. So he started out in Germany, and then he went to Spain. And then he became the prominent leader in Spain. So the Rush, Rabbeinu Asher, was really the authority who wasn't much bridged, but really was a bridge between the Sephardi and Ashkenazi world. There were some correspondence, but you had someone, you had the leader of now the Spanish community who is living in Germany. So he could present and he was able to write with the knowledge and with experience of the different places. And with that, he managed to compose his halachic work in his commentary of the Gemara, but also many people did had other works. The Rush has the Orchos Chaim, which is more of like a Musar type of work. Rabbeinu Tam has the Sefer Yashar, also more philosophical work. Meaning these great people weren't just limited to halacha and to commentary in the Talmud. We're just focusing on that, but we have to note that they did a lot more than that.
So already in the 12th, end of the 13th century, there were significant differences in customs between Sephardim and Ashkenazim.
It was probably more local, meaning I don't know if it was necessarily Sephardim and Ashkenazim, but different places had different customs. But to make sort of divided into basically two, you have this chunk is Ashkenazi, this chunk is Sephardim. I don't know if you really had that.
Mm-hmm. It's hard to say, because one of the tricks that used to be played all the time is they would make the Jews be moneylenders. And then royalty didn't want to pay its debts, what they would do then is stir up a pogrom. And it worked all the time. In one place, what's it called? Worms.
Yeah.
A big community in Germany. They literally drove every Jew into the synagogue and then set it on fire. This was during the Crusades.
Right, this was the time of the Mara Mirutenberg in the Valley of, this was during that time.
You can make rules when you're surrounded by no rules.
Right, but
they did it. They tried.
Right, but you see, look at this. Look at Rashi, Tosos, the Rush, the Rif. They were all. This was all under these circumstances.
Wonderful. Yeah.
That's what I mentioned when we started this, is like we take for granted the fact that all of these works exist. Well, you know, just consider the times that
they were. If the Sephardim were in Egypt, they pretty much could do what they wanted to do at first.
Right. There wasn't necessarily a unified Sephardi or even, you know, unified Ashkenazi.
Morocco, per se. Morocco's
there. Right.
Depends on who's ruling the area they were in.
Right. And even afterwards, there's still differences. But that was the rush. And he had the advantage of being able to reference different works from different places and had familiarity with different customs. So the rush had a son. His son was the Torah. His son was named the Torah. He wrote a Sefer Arba Torah. He literally four roads. And in the Torah, virtually on every page, it's called, Adoni Avi Harush. You'll see he quotes his father. He quotes his father very frequently. So that was Rabbeinu Yaakov ben Usher. And also, he started out in Germany, then went to Spain, and then did most of his writing in Spain. And the Torah really does something similar to the Rambam in many ways, more similar to what the Rambam did than necessarily what the Rush and the Rif did. And that is organize halacha, not just go in the order of the pages of the Talmud, but create different sections. He created four sections. Arba Torim is because there were Orach Chaim is the way of life, but the laws of daily living. That's what we're doing in Mishneh Berurah. Mishneh Berurah is a later commentary to the Shulchan Aruch and Orach Chaim. But the laws of daily living, waking up, tefillah, Shabbos, holidays, and then there was Yoredeya, which is sort of not miscellaneous, but it has Yoredeya is probably most well known for the laws of kashrus, the laws of meat and milk, of mixtures, but also nidahs in Yoredeya, the laws of mezuzah, laws of avelus, of mourning, laws of we discussed last Friday night about beard and peyas in Yoredeya. It's kind of the miscellaneous category. Choshen Mishpat is financial law, and Evan Ezer is primarily marriage and divorce.
Is that how smicha is divided up?
How what?
Isn't that how smicha is divided?
Right, a lot of these. Right, so what, sort of the standard smicha is learning Yoredeya. But in parts of Yoredeya, like kashrus, and also, nida, velus, things like that. I think they assume you learn Orach Chaim on your own. One of the criticisms, you assume, you learn Hilchos Shabbos on your own. I mean, you should, but that's sort of the standard curriculum. And there's yadin smicha, which is dai to be a dai, and that's more on choshen mishpat. But the Shulchan Aruch, as we'll see how that developed, that's based on the format of the order, the chapter headings of the Torah. So the Torah, in his introduction, says, why did he compose this? So he says that a result of the endless exile, this number three, we become weakened. Hearts have become numb, our hands feeble, our eyes dim, our ears deaf, and our tongues dumb. Our power of speech has been taken from us, the wellsprings of our wisdom have become plugged up. Basically, we're not able to go through all the different opinions, all the analysis of the Talmud. So he says, therefore, my thoughts moved me and got me thinking about what to do. I took upon myself to examine the holy books and gain an understanding of them. He said, then I would pick two or three of the main teachings of the authors and clarify them in a manner that would leave no doubt. So he divides it into these four sections and draws upon all the works that we've seen so far. Rashi, the Bali Tosfos, his father, the Rush, the Rambam. And he, one of the differences between the Rambam's Mishneh Torah and the Torah is that, number one, the Rambam's Mishneh Torah also deals with laws that are not currently applicable, the laws of Karbanos and the Beis HaMikdash. The Torah and the Shulchan Aruch don't deal with that. And also, the Torah provides the analysis of his position. The Rambam really doesn't. You can analyze how it is that the Rambam came to its conclusion. You can analyze the words that he used, but he didn't give an analysis. He just gave his bottom line ruling. Whereas the Torah would present more of the background.
So the Rambam talks about the Beis Hamikdash a lot?
Yeah. And but one thing that the Torah didn't do, actually similar to the Rambam, was he didn't necessarily give you all of the discussion basically from the Talmud to the Rishonim to his conclusion. A little bit more than the Rambam did, but not in a way that you'd be able to see the sugya, the whole topic and the bottom line ruling from start to finish. But Rabbi Yosef Karo, who came a little bit after him, the Torah was in the 1300s. Yosef Karo was in the late 1400s and mid 1500s. So he was from Spain originally. Then he went to Turkey, and then he settled in the land of Israel. Apparently had a chavrusa with the Arizal and a Magid, some sort of divine inspiration. So he's also well-versed, the Rabbi Yosef Karo, who's the order of the Beis Yosef and then the Shulchan Aruch, but was very, very deep into Kabbalah, and they lived in the times of the Arizal, the Rama as well, Rabbi Yosef, Rabbi Moshe Isserles as well. They were very well-versed in Kabbalah.
Very much so.
Sorry?
Very much so, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But very, very much so. So that he was in Sfat, and so first he composed his commentary on the Torah called the Beis Yosef. His name was Yosef Karo, the Beis Yosef. So what Rabbi Yosef Karo did is he presents all of the sources from start to finish to explain the Torah's ruling. He also presents opinions of other Rishonim, and he gives an authoritative ruling. So you see in the show and tell, you have the Torah, and then you have the Beis Yosef. Then you have here the Bais Chadash, that's the Bach of Yul Circus. But the Beis Yosef is really an explanation on the Torah, but also provides his bottom line ruling as well as the opinions of others that aren't quoted by the Torah. Yosef Karo also wrote the Kesef Mishnah, which is on the Mishnah Torah, also providing, not as long, but providing notes about where the Rambam got his rulings from.
So do they line up, the bottom line rulings?
With the Torah?
Is that all like building on each other and adding to each other? So do they all have the same bottom line ruling, just a different explanation?
So not necessarily. Certainly between the Rambam and the Torah, not necessarily. And
in here, for instance,
even the
Beis Yosef on the Torah.
Not necessarily. He may.
Or the Bach.
Yeah, so not necessarily.
Even when that.
Gemara
might
be anything. Okay. I'm sorry, go
ahead. Right. So because we'll see what did Rabbi Yosef Karo do? So also in his introduction, the same thing as the very similar to the Torah, why there's a need to explain all the halakha, and he has good reference to the Torah, that basically now the Torah becomes essential, and the Rambam becomes essential, at least to look at. But the Rabbi Yosef Karo's methodology, and it has a very solid basis to take this approach, is he picked what he dealt with, the Amudei Halacha, the pillars of Halacha. And that was the Rambam, the Rif, and the Rush. And basically what his approach was, if two out of three ruled one way and one ruled the other way, so that would be the way the Beis Yosef would rule. You would take two out of three.
Majority.
Right, the majority. And there's that Halachic principle, Achir Rabam Lahatos, that you do generally go after the majority. So that was and he says that was basically his methodology. But what if there was an area of halacha where he wasn't able to do it? Let's say they each said something different. You couldn't get to two out of three. Okay, so then he went to the other Rishonim, the Rashba, the Ran, the Mordechai, the Smag, and would also factor in those other opinions. But his basic approach is the Rambam, the Rush, and the Rif, two out of three, that would be the way that Rabbi Yosef Karo would rule. But again, that's very solid halachic basis. You should go after the majority. Again, the majority has to be the majority of people who matter. But that was his approach. And then the you see the Beis Yosef is rather lengthy. You know, here his whole idea is to make halacha more accessible, but it's very lengthy. So then he shortened his rulings. Much of them are based on the Beis Yosef, but he abridged his rulings in the what he called the Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch, the set table, meaning you have all of these other different things, but now you set the table with the Shulchan Aruch. So this is standard issue of Shulchan Aruch. So you have the Riosakara, the Shulchan Aruch. So it's referred to as the Machaber, the one who put together the book, or somebody who called it the base, referring to him as the base. And then you'll see here in most editions, either Rashi script or smaller script, it's the Ramah, Ramosha Isser list for Ashkenazim. So then he, Yosef Karo, put that in the Shulchan Aruch. And that was the set table, that you want to look something up. Sometimes he did assume that you knew the Beis Yosef and you did the analysis. Sometimes you see the Shulchan Aruch, you can't necessarily, you know, understand the underpinnings of the rulings. But that was the Shulchan Aruch. And it was similar, I think, not to the extent, but in much the same way that the Mishnah and then the Talmud became absolutely authoritative, the Shulchan Aruch was very similar. Is that at least in the entire Sephardi world and the at the time and in the decades and centuries to follow, more or less, not 100%, but more or less, at least the authority of the Shulchan Aruch, the centrality of the Shulchan Aruch was accepted. Are there some cases where some of the Achronim, the ones that came after, at least the early ones, have different rulings? Sometimes the Vilna Gaon may argue. Sometimes you have the Shach and the Taz. You may have some, but basically the Shulchan Aruch was accepted as authoritative. And it was because the people accepted it. So you had establish the Sephardi community? So number six, Ramosha Chagiz and Lachos Ketanos says it was accepted basically from in the land of Israel, Babylon, Syria, Turkey, Egypt, from in all that area, they accepted the rulings of Rav Yosef Karo in the Shulchan Aruch. And what about the Ashkenazim? So Rav Moshe Isserles, who lived in Krakow, 1530 to 1572. He was 42 when he died. I don't know until recently, but he was also working on a similar project. He had a commentary to the Torah, the Darkei Moshe, named after Moshe Isserles. So he also wrote a commentary on the Torah, similar type of thing, the Darkei Moshe. So you have down here. And he was also running commentary to the Torah. And he was working on a similar project, had the same idea, but then knew that Rabbi Yosef Karo had also gotten a little bit farther on the project. So what do you do when someone else is working on the same thing you are? So you don't try to get ahead of them and outdo them. You say, okay, I'll just add my glosses for when they're needed.
Sure.
Right? You have the Shulchan Aruch, and you have the Mappah. In most editions, they'll say Hagah, the glosses, but the Mappah, the tablecloth. You have the Shulchan Aruch, and then the Ramah puts the tablecloth. And he says where Ashkenazi practice is different, or if there's a specific Ashkenazi practice. So why didn't Rav Moshe Isserles just accept everything the Beis Yosef said? Because his methodology and the methodology of seemed like others in the Ashkenazi world was a little bit different. He didn't really accept the two out of three thing, even though there is a general principle, you go after the majority. But he also felt that it was important to determine the bottom line halacha according to the principle of halacha kibasroi, that halacha goes according to the later authorities. Now that's all within a period, but you have in the Gemara, let's say within the period of the Amoraim, the sages of the Talmud. So you had one who came in the 3rd century, one who came in the 4th century. So you generally go according to the one who came later because they were already familiar with all the rulings that came before, and they took that all into account. Now, in the different periods, you're not going to say, oh, the Rishonim came later than the Talmud Bavli, so you go according to them. But with each, within each period, and some are more defined than others. The Talmud is very defined, the period of the Rishonim may be less defined, but you go after later authorities, because they saw the other ones of the early they saw all of the things that were written by the early authorities. And the Rama, or Moshe Isserles, took the Trumas Hadeshin, Rabbi Yisrael Isserlin, and the Maharil, who lived in Germany. And also, if you look in Shulchan Aruch, many of what the Rama quotes, many of the Minhagim we have, particularly with Tefillah, even things like the 3 weeks, where Ashkenazim do what they do, different than Sephardim, is based on the Maharil. It lived in Germany. So the Yosef Karo was taking basically the Hamude Halacha, the pillars of Halacha that he used, were basically in the Sephardi world. The Rif, certainly Rif and the Rambam. The Rush was kind of a crossover. But the Rama felt that it was important to take into account more recent authorities and also authorities that had more impact on the practice of Ashkenazi Jews. So,
can we still do that now? If a very contemporary Rav is making a ruling on something, are they looking at the last 100 years, or are they going?
Right. So it's hard to define when exactly, how far exactly you take it, because we also have a principle that the generations who came earlier have a certain greater understanding. So it's more used between people who are basically contemporaries. I mean, you obviously want us to live a little bit before and after, but you have a more recent example of it. But
when we were having the shiur about the contemporary rulings, that really only applied now and didn't apply then. We were doing organ donations.
Right, so you would take into account, by nature, more recent.
So you would take into account the last 50 years.
But that's also right. That's
even
count.
But there would be something in the Gemara maybe about how you treat
that point. That it's based on, yeah, for sure. So Rabbi Yosef Karo didn't use this principle because he felt it was basically only applicable in the Talmud itself. So it's a little bit unclear how, I think it was a little bit of a novelty that Rav Moshe Isserles did that within the Rishonim themselves. So I'm not sure how much we can say we really do that, at least as a general principle. So this was, okay, so you get to, Rabbi Yosef Karo was in the Sephardi world.
Right.
And he made the Beis Yosef, the Shulchan Aruch, and that became accepted basically in the broader world that we call the Sephardi world. Look at and that was that. Rav Moshe Isserles was in Krakow. Maybe I didn't say that. He was in Krakow. He's in Poland. He was in Poland. And he knew about this project, and again, he accepted most of what Rabbi Yosef Karo ruled, and there was correspondence between them, but he felt for the Ashkenazim, there were some different minhagim, some different methodology that he wanted to incorporate when necessary. So when there was...
What sources was it? You said he was using the...
Maril and the Trumas Hadeshen.
Right.
So is it because of practical
differences? The Maril and the Trumas Hadeshen, what... Were there books as profound as the Rush, the Rambam, and the Rif?
I think they were. I mean, they were different styles. The Trumas Hadeshen is a lot of more like Shailos and Tshuvas, Responsa, the Maril. I mean, they were just very influential. I think that's probably why he insisted that they couldn't just be discarded, because you had Jews in Germany and Poland. Their Minhagim were very much influenced by, particularly the Trumas Hadeshen, the Maril, but also Rashi and Tosfos, much more so. So I wasn't just going to give that up, because it had an impact, so it had such an impact in how the practice was.
Another thing about Rashi is that a lot of his stuff was written by other people. They just used his name.
Is that so? I don't know. Could be.
I don't mind, but...
There are some Masechta, some tractates where it's listed, where it's printed as Rashi, but everyone knows it's not really Rashi. Like in Masechet Nedarim, people call it the Mefarish, but it's not really written by Rashi, but the printer has always printed it as Rashi. But there are some places where that's kind of known that it's not Rashi. But yeah, so why they, Ashkenazi practice, again, it wasn't defined, you know, we're Ashkenazim and we're Sephardim, but the practice in Germany, Poland, was very much influenced by some of those later authorities. And the Ramah felt that it was appropriate to incorporate them, and that he, even as far as his methodology, that you, there was an emphasis on including the more recent authorities, the ones who came in the 14th century, 15th century. And then the, so we have the Beis Yosef that was accepted by the Sephardim, and you have, and they have,
you don't really have an Ashkenazi rabbi who ever took halakha and organized it the way the Sephardim, Rabbanim did it. Nobody took it and said, yeah, the Rambam who does his work, you have the Rif, you have the Rush.
Well, the Darkei Moshe on the Torah does. The Ramah's commentary, Ramosha Isserles, his commentary on the Torah does it. It's not as long
so
as it.
He was pretty much the only one, though, that we...
Who did that? Right, the Rush. Right.
No, nobody quite organized it. Not to take away, I mean, like, yeah, yeah. The Rush and the Bali Tosfos.
They were war with the Gemara.
Yeah. They just never took it and put it in an organized set the way we see.
That was really the Rabbah and the Torah did that, right. Right. And also, I'll just note, the Shulchan Aruch is based on the divisions and chapters and everything on the Torah. So, you know, Simon Aleph, Simon Beis, and Shulchan Aruch and Torah is the same.
I think a lot of the thinkers now are like, I would go, you know, what, you know, we're basically looking at faith as what it is.
Right, the practice and what the lived experience.
Actually, I'm going to put that in, but we'll see how it goes.
And so, but then when it came to the Darkei Moshe, right, did more of the analysis, but then when it came to the Shulchan Aruch, the set table, so he knew that Rabbi Yosef Karo was working on this, so most cases is basically the same, though probably in, you know, virtually every, you know, section in Shulchan Aruch, there's some comment of the Ramah. Generally, they're shorter. And a lot of times the Ramah will say, you know, B'medinos ha'elu, in our countries, like Anu Noah again, like this, we're accustomed to do like this. You'll see a lot of times it's the Ma'aril in the parentheses, based on the Ma'aril. So as far as Ashkenazim, so the Ashkenazim accepted the Shulchan Aruch with the commentaries of the Ramah. So basically they accepted the Ramah as their authority. I mean, they accepted the Shulchan Aruch with the comments of the Ramah. And how do we get Ashkenazim? So it became, right, the Jews in Germany and Poland and Lithuania and Russia, they basically accepted the rulings of the Ramah. And that was kind of, other than geographically, that was kind of how there became a more of a unified Ashkenazi identity. It's basically those who accepted the rulings of Moshe Isserles. But then after that, there was still discussion. Like, this is supposed to be the set table. Then you have the Magen Avraham, I know the Taz, Torei Zav, who came the centuries after that, the 1600s, and then also you have the Gra, the Vilna Gaon, Rabbi Akiva Eiger, the Prima Gaudim. You have commentaries on this, and that's actually we saw when we started our Mishnah Berurah. That was the introduction to the Mishnah Berurah. Is okay, you have the Shulchan Aruch, but now open a standard edition of Shulchan Aruch. You have all these commentaries, so the Mishnah Berurah is going to make it a little bit easier and give you a shorter commentary. Then you have, Deer Shoot, then you have other things. So there's always, commentaries on every attempt to make things shorter and simpler. But that's basically how we got to, at least as far as sort of, halakhic communities, differences between Ashkenazim and Sephardim. Sephardim totally accepted Rabbi Yosef Karo and his influence of the Rambam, the Rif, and the Rush. And Ashkenazim, by and large, accepted the rulings and the comments of Ramosha Isserles, and basically followed that. So, one example is Kitnios, that Shulchan Aruch says, of course, it's not chametz, it can't become chametz, and you can fill the mitzvah of matzah with it. And he says, but in our places where we're no egg, we're accustomed to refraining from it. So just one example. But that's the kind of thing that the Ramah would do, is if there was something that didn't account for an Ashkenazi custom, so he'll comment. Or maybe add in a certain detail to clarify something. And that's how we got the more defined, the two tracks of Ashkenazim and Sephardim. Yeah. Okay. And, then after that, even within the Ashkenazi lands and Sephardic lands, there is a diversity of practice. You have in the Sephardic lands, you have the Ben Ish Chai, the Chidah, you have the Medin, you have the Taz, the Shach, the Bilagon, you have other, the Prichadash in Svardi Lev, meaning you have commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch. What Ravadi Yosef, who lived in the 21st century, what he did, and it was, I think, tremendously influential on Sephardi communities nowadays, is he, over the centuries, not all in the broader community of Sephardim necessarily did like the Shulchan Aruch. You know, Maran, they call it Shulchan Aruch, Maran Beit Yosef. There was some, you know, the Ben Ish Chai in Iraq. There were different communities that didn't necessarily do everything like the Shulchan Aruch. One of Rabbi Yavadi Yosef's big emphasis was that all the Sephardi world should go back to the Maran, back to the Shulchan Aruch of Yosef Karo. And with that, he, I think, was very influential in kind of establishing a more, what we call, Sephardi identity, even the Jews from the Middle East, from Spain. It was largely, at least in recent times, it was largely his influence that there became a more unified Sephardi practice. But he said that it was going back to what the Shulchan Aruch was, that then there became those other things. I don't think the Ashkenazi world has really, at least recently, has been an equivalent to that. But that was a major impact that Rav Avadia Yosef had in Sephardi practice. I mean, it was also with some, maybe with a little bit of controversy, because what about Jews? Some Sephardim did have their own things, and he was very insistent that, a strong personality, but he was very insistent that, Sephardim should follow, Maran Beit Yosef, the Shulchan Aruch. So that was sort of also a restart. Through the generations, you get a kind of diversity of practices, and then diversity is also a good thing. But that's kind of how you how we end up with Ashkenazim and Sephardim in a small nutshell.
Thank you.